From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. In his first State of the State speech, Governor Nathan Deal said criminal justice reform would be at the top of his to-do list. As Deal prepares to leave office 8 years later, Georgia's prison population is 12% smaller than previously projected. The incarceration rate for black men is down 30%, and the number committed to the Department of Juvenile Justice has dropped 46%. For those who have served time, staying out of the system is an uphill climb, which is where Gangsters to Growers digs in. The Atlanta organization helps young people who've been incarcerated get back on track through farming. Founder Abiodun Henderson joins us now in the studio. Abiodun, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for being here. Also with me, two trainees from the program, Dariante Trent and Raven Cantrell. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Now, I realize that this just gets you out of farm duties for today. Is that part of why you're here?
You actually don't. So we actually got to go to the farm today. And it's kind of cold, but Miss Abby is like, oh, we're still going to go on the farm. We're just going to do some other work, you know?
Well, you got him here. Thanks so much, Abiodun. But statistically, 50% of young people who've been incarcerated are back in the system within 3 years. So what are some of the particular challenges for a young person leaving detention or keeping them out in the first place?
The number one cause of mass incarceration is poverty. So when we look at the crimes that are being committed or allegedly being committed by young people, they tend to revolve around selling drugs, mostly marijuana, and, robberies. So that tells us right there that obviously, these young people need economic opportunities. Then there's some mental illness situations. There's, homelessness is another factor. We have young people in our program that have been homeless, and their housing isn't secure. And then we have the environment in our communities that are affected by poverty. So it's highly stressful situations in our neighborhood. So everyone's highly stressed. And then so you see a lot of fighting happening, aggravated assaults, all those things. So that tells us that there's folks that need therapy, right?
Right.
So, I think those are the things that, keep the revolving door going within the criminal justice system.
So I focus on farming as part of the solution against the high rate of incarceration and reincarceration.
Yeah, well, farming is just one of the things that we do, right? We focus on that because not only is it meditative, it's also giving people the skills to be self-sufficient. And then we're supporting farmers that don't have labor. So if they don't have labor, then we're not growing the maximum amount of food that we can grow in order to be able to feed our schools, the young people in our schools and our community. So farming is just one of the many solutions.
Well, there's a lot of data behind you to support the idea that poverty is a huge contributor to incarceration rate in our country. But I'm wondering for you, Dariante, for example, what was it for you that pulled you away from, well, let's say the straight and narrow path?
Just seeing stuff in my everyday environment. I grew up in around the gang-infested activity, around people that was used to robbing and killing. So quite naturally, I adapted a few habits that weren't ideal.
How did you end up in prison? Or in juvenile prison?
Well, I had caught a few felony charges at 15 that carried me over until I was 17, and they was able to charge me as an adult. So they sentenced me to 2 years in prison at 17.
How about for you, Raven? What happened for you?
I've actually seen myself going to jail too much, and I was resigning and raised in Clayton County, Georgia. So once you're in there, it seemed like you just can't get out. It's like they just come back after you again and again and again. And it's like that's not the everyday life that you would like to see.
How old are you now?
I just turned 21 on the 30th of December.
Mm-hmm. So prison, of course, is supposed to be a deterrent. Was it for you?
I never went to prison.
You didn't?
I just went to county jail. Mm-hmm. And again, overall jail system is not.
What kind of charges were you in for?
My first was theft by taking, which is now labeled as Grand Theft Auto. Mm-hmm. I took my mother's car and she pressed charges on me. Then I had a failure to appear in court for that charge. Then I had possession less than an ounce and did time served for that. And I ended up going to jail with this female for shoplifting.
Mm-hmm.
And now everything is clear, but now I have another charge just because it was in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Mm-hmm.
And my charge is now intent to distribute, possession of marijuana, intent to distribute.
Did you get any kind of job training or counseling on how to get life back together after serving time?
I did not, because I just be to myself most of the time. So when it's like when I ask for help or cry out for help, I really don't do it. I just go and find it and see where life takes me, and I run into the right people. Prime example, here's Miss Abby, and now I'm into Gangsters to Growers, making my life better, making better decisions, choosing the right path, and yet again, I feel like that hope that I've been looking for, I actually got it.
How did you find her?
I've actually known a member in this group before, and he was like, you know, because I had to do community service. So he was like, you could talk to Miss Abby. Miss Abby can help you with the community service. You can work with us on the farm. And I'm just like, okay, well, let me see. And I gave her a call. She was like, well, see me tomorrow and we can work something out. And ever since then, I've just been ongoing.
How about for you, Dariante? Did you get any kind of training or counseling on how to get your life back together after being in jail?
Not at all. They put me back in the streets in my original neighborhood around the same people that I had been around my whole life and told me to find a way to get out.
Mm. How did you come in contact with Gangsters to Growers?
Actually, a friend I went to school with over the summer, he found out about the program when it was first starting, and he had told me that it would be an opportunity that I couldn't pass, and I guarantee you it's an opportunity that I wouldn't expect to be in the past, but right now I wouldn't see myself without it.
Mm. That's Dariante Trent, also with us Raven Cantrell. They're both trainees in the Gangsters to Growers program, founded by Abiodun Henderson, who is also with us. Abiodun, you moved to Georgia in the mid-2000s. So what was it that drew you here?
Well, me, myself, as a young person, at their age, they both just turned 21 in the last few days. When I was 21, I found myself in an abusive relationship and in New Orleans. And my friend's mother just... When we came to visit Atlanta, she showed me different opportunities, and I stayed here. I never went back to New Orleans.
And you were in the restaurant business here,
and
too,
I was
right?
in the restaurant business in New Orleans and here. And, you know, I was doing that for about 14 years in fine dining, making good money, enjoying life, able to purchase a house at the age of 26 in the West End neighborhood, Westview neighborhood, you know, living life.
So how did you become involved in urban farming and the local food movement?
Well, after losing my house in 2011,
It was foreclosed on?
It was foreclosed on. Yeah. I even received a check 2 years later saying they illegally foreclosed on me. By then, I was a full-blown activist, and that wasn't one of my priorities. But, right when I was foreclosed on, my father also passed away around the same time. And the Occupy movement started about 9 days later after my father passed away on September 1st. And my mother, being of African descent from Liberia, West Africa, the Kru tribe, which we were known to be the hardest to enslave, KRU, Kru tribe, represent. And my father was a rank-and-file Black Panther member. So it's always been in me to fight for what's right. And I got the opportunity once the Occupy movement came around and met the founder of Occupy the Hood, Malik Rahsaan.
So what were the first steps in setting up an actual urban farm?
Well, the first one that I started was on my block. We went to City Hall, found out who owned the property. We contacted him. He said that we could use the land. And we began planting and teaching babies in the neighborhood. And after that, after getting training from True Living Well, one of the premier urban farms here in Atlanta, that happens to be a Black Ran, I took over the community garden in that same community, like three blocks away from where I was living, the Westview Community Garden. And it was great getting resources from the Atlanta Community Food Bank and their garden division, getting volunteers, really interacting with all the children in the neighborhood and making sure they knew how to grow food, giving out rain barrels. It was really fun and exciting.
But at the same time that you started working with kids and teens, your neighborhood, Westview, began intensively gentrifying. How did that affect your work with the community?
So about six of the families that used to come to the garden were displaced. These were folks that were on Section 8 housing that were used by homeowners to hold down their properties until they saw the neighborhood changing or the housing prices rise. So folks that had been in the neighborhood for 10, 15 years were now being told to move within 2 to 3 months. And I just saw that happening again and again. And I literally saw a family of six children that used to walk across the street to come to the garden. You know, their grandmother called me in a panic saying, they're telling us to move. They're telling us to move. And I just watched that happen over and over again. I would go to the neighborhood organization since I was a part of the executive board as the person that ran the community garden and would say, hey, you know, I hope we're not displacing people, you know, as the housing prices rise, you know, I hope that's not. And I was told repeatedly, oh, we want to form a nonprofit to keep the elders in their house. We want to do this, we want to do that. And then I would watch them do the opposite. You know, it was the organization was filled with real estate agents and people that were interested in the American dream, right? So at the same time, it's hard to really blame them, you know, because they're just spokes in the wheels of this system. But at the same time, when being told the truth, you know, by people in the community, like, this isn't what we want to see, they still continued with the same, you know, promoting, marketing the neighborhood as up and coming. And now the houses, my house was $88,000 when I bought it in 2008. And now the houses are going for $200,000 to $400,000 in that neighborhood.
So tremendous pressure on the real estate in those communities. So how do you recruit young people to this program?
Well, being active for the last 6 years on the West Side, I've met a lot of young people, and I really just go canvass the neighborhoods. You know, as a grassroots organizer, that's what we know to do, is to go around the neighborhood and say, hey, do you know anyone that has been formerly incarcerated that's looking for work? We're going to be working in this farm right behind me or around this corner. You know, and then that's how I met our first two trainees, Erica and Quan, which Erica's in the lobby right now. And then, like these young people said, now the young people are recruiting their friends. So people ask all the time, do you have a connection with the DOJ, the Department of Justice? Do you have a connection with the juvenile justice system? And I tell them, really, I let the trainees recruit their friends. And that way we're actually changing an ecosystem.
Well, it sounds like it is working. I'm speaking with Abiodun Henderson. She's founder of the urban farming group Gangsters to Growers. Dariante Trent is also with us, and Raven Cantrell. They're trainees in the program. We're going to hear more about their story when we come back. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott, and I'm talking with Abiodun Henderson, who founded Gangsters to Growers. That's a program that pulls on several different threads in American culture right now: urban farming, gentrification, incarceration. The program trains young people who were previously incarcerated in farming and also in entrepreneurship. Trainees Dariante Trent and Raven Cantrell are also with us. Dariante, Raven, who wants to walk me through a typical day on the farm? What are you doing from 8 to 5?
Typical day on the farm, depending on which one we at. So a typical day at True Living Well might be in the wintertime doing compost. So that's breaking open bags, but making sure to discard any trash. So, because trash don't break down, so the whole point of compost is to have material that breaks down within itself to make the soil healthier within the beds when you decide to plant. So we have like orange peels, banana peels, you know, lettuce, collards, apples, you know, a few things that that break down and
decompose.
Yeah, decompose pretty much. So we
So what time do you get there in the morning?
About 9:30, 10, somewhere around up and through that, till 1 o'clock.
Till one, yeah.
So right in the morning, do you start right on the farm, or you guys do something else as a group activity?
So from 8:30 to at least 9 to 9:30, we do yoga.
Really?
Yeah.
So is that the first time you've done yoga?
Yeah. So joining the program was my first time ever scratching my body the way I did.
Do you work on, you said something about being on one farm. Do you work on the same farm every day or different farms?
No, we work on a few black-owned farms around the Atlanta area.
So, Raven, what kept you with it?
What kept me with going to the farm?
Yeah, like, why did you stay with this program?
It is unique. It's very different. I never, first of all, this is a job, and we come to work to do yoga, therapy, management classes. We go to the garden to make compost and learn how to garden, even though that's like pretty fun until it gets cold. And then you have these events that we are invited to. Like we've went to the village market quite a few times. Then we've been to the Buckhead banquet at the Marriott Hotel.
It was the Grand Hyatt. Yeah.
The Grand Hyatt. Oh my gosh, that was so beautiful.
By the Kellogg Foundation. And we went to the village market to sell hot sauce.
Yes.
Hot sauce. Tell me about the hot sauce story, because that is a product that you produce.
So we through, you know, working in fine dining, and then, well, actually Beyonce. We got a credit. It comes down to Beyonce. When she said hot sauce in my bag, swag, I said, oh, we're part of SWAG, Southwest Atlanta Growers Cooperative, which is a black urban farm cooperative here in Atlanta. And she said, hot sauce? Yeah, we were thinking about some type of sauce, and hot sauce is going to be it. So we infuse our hot sauce with turmeric, lavender. It has alkaline water, apple cider vinegar, pink Himalayan salt, the finest products. And we've been featured in Bon Appetit magazine. We're at Farm Burger, the Pullman, Fresh Harvest, a couple of different places carry our hot sauce.
What's the name of the hot sauce so people can look out for it?
Sweet Soul.
Yes. Sweet Soul. You guys sound like you're ready for the commercial all together now. Well, Abiodun, this began, as any other project does, with a vision. And how have you been able to sustain operations and funding and community buy-in? Because you have to pay people.
Yes, I'm used to doing programs without real budgets. So I did a camp in Westview Community for 3 years in a row. The last year is when we had some funding from the Community Foundation, about $5,000, $4,000. So, you know, I knew it really takes people power to pull anything off. But thanks to one of our board members, Tammy Boyd, who's out of the Food Oasis organization, she had a meeting with Workforce, the Workforce Development Program here in the City of Atlanta, now called WorkSource, and told them about the program. We met with them, and they said, yes, we're willing to provide the $15 an hour for your trainees as their stipend. And once we had that secure, even though I don't have a salary, we don't have any staff that have salaries, I knew if we pushed forward, things would come. So far, we've had about $25,000 that has come through in increments that has helped sustain us. We sell hot sauce to help sustain us. But, you know, we're running a $300,000 a year program institution. So we're making it do what it do. But we are also working with our partnerships with True Living Well, and just trying to find the money to sustain this and really build the business and the worker-owned cooperative, which is one of our main goals, that will really sustain this so we don't ever have to ask anyone for money.
You mentioned that you get a lot of lip or develop projects like this get a lot of lip service in communities that are gentrifying. Oh, yes, we would like to make sure that elders can stay here or people who have affordable housing. What has been the response in those communities to fields of collards and kale and people coming in to grow every day?
Well, everyone's excited to see the youth. Everyone's excited to educate the youth. Everyone loves community gardens. But if we're honest about a few things, speaking on the gardens, you know, gardens, community gardens are a tool of gentrification, which is sad, right? That would be something that raises the property values and displaces people that need access to the fresh food, which a lot of things that we experience here in this country and city are a lot of contradictions to just humanity. So, yeah, everyone is excited, but it's also used to raise property values at the same time.
So you become part of the problem
We become part of the problem. And I didn't realize it when I used to see the garden on the website that was created by some of the colonizers, gentrifiers, displacers, or just American citizens looking for the American dream. You know, when I saw it on the website, I'm like, yay, you know, they're promoting it and it's going to bring more people to volunteer. It's going to be all the things. But no, it was like, look at all this great work that we're doing in this community. Look at this camp that we have. Look at, we're inclusive. Don't you want to be part of an inclusive community, you know, type of thing. And it was used to really fast forward the gentrification process. And one thing I really have to mention, when we're talking about the criminal justice system, we're talking about the youth, we need to admit the fact that there have been studies that say that young people's brains aren't fully formed until they turn 25. So how are we jailing? How, when we go to the court system, it's nothing but young people under the age of 25 that are being, you know, treated as adults with a fully functioning brain that have been raised in the right situation and should know exact right from wrong, you know, instead of going with their survival instincts of I need food in my stomach, I'm going to get it how I can. How are we complicit, all of us, me, you, young people, how are we complicit in a system that knows that the young people's brains aren't even fully formed to make decisions in the right way, and we decide to fund our city through these arrests? It's just completely wrong.
Dariante, I'm wondering for you, you know, I'm not guessing that you're going to become a farmer, or are you thinking that that's something you'll do? What where do you want to go from here in this program?
So my main goal right now is to use the program to not only help me get better, but to help my community get better too, you know, change the people around me. So right now I'm trying to actually invite a lot of my friends to join the program before it becomes to a point where, you know, we got an actual waiting list for the program because people signing up quickly.
Mentioned that you're taking you learned some management skills. Do you imagine yourselves going on to do something else, maybe managing projects after learning what you've learned here?
Probably in the future. Well, I actually see myself doing something like what you do, you know, broadcasting. I actually want to I want to use my voice for something more, you know.
You got a nice, warm voice.
Thank you.
You can keep working on that. But how about for you, Raven? You said, you know, you kept getting caught in the system, that it kept coming back for you. What has this program taught you about your own role in that and how you want to live your life?
Okay. When we would sit down and talk to each other into, like, group therapy or whatever, I would really sit and open up and really open my mind to what is it that I really want to do. And when I really joined this program and realized that there is so many opportunities that I can get warmed up to and actually work for and get so much money for it, I would love to. I just love this program so much because Miss Abby even mentioned me to this Text for Girl program, and that helped me up even a lot to let me even think about being a data scientist or an analysis. To just be like, that's probably part of one of the careers that I might pursue myself to be. And with this program, I actually want to stay in it and stick my foot into it and just see how far we could go to be like a CEO of it, or hopefully it gets that big and, you know, help Miss Abby run it. And, you know, really just get a lot of kids to open their eyes and let them know, like, there's bigger and better out there besides what they got to offer you. So,
well, and thinking that you're talking about that, did you ever, when you were growing up, see yourself as running an organization? I mean, what did you imagine for your future?
I always said I wanted to speak for girls because I'm a young girl, and I've been by myself for so long. I have a brother, but we haven't grown up together. So I was the only child. I lost my father. I lost my grandfather. My mom is a single mother. She's very hardworking. All she knows how to do is work. And it's like, what is it that I want to do? Because my mom wants me to do better. That's all I was told. My granddad wants me to do better. My dad wants me to do better. So it's like, what is it that I want to do that is better for me? Because, again, I've made a lot of mistakes. I can admit my wrong, but I know how to turn around and say, hey, I don't want to do that no more. I want to be better. I want to be that. I want to be somebody.
So, Abia Dunn, looking at this program, what do you envision for the future?
The future is a 1,000 worker strong, worker owned cooperative. I belong to a church in the West End that where we own, we're one of the largest black farm owners. We own 4,000 acres in South Carolina where it's legal to grow hemp. And as a people, as black folks, I realize a lot of us realize we don't produce anything, we don't manufacture anything. So, why can't we make toilet tissue, paper towels, clothes, fuel, hemp milk, anything that you can make out of hemp? Why don't we manufacture it for the world, for the city, for the country? So that's what I see. And that's what Raven is mentioning. You know, what I see is owning a building, you know, where it's really almost like a school, you know, where we have groups of 20 going in and out of all different classes, going to different five different farms each day. You know, we have a group of 20 at different farms. And then, you know, in the afternoon, everyone's going into all the different classes, which are, you know, group therapy, financial literacy. We have business classes at Clark Atlanta, economic organizing classes, which teaches about worker cooperative development, nutritional cooking, environmental responsibility, where they're learning how to be zero wasters, writing classes, boxing classes. We have so many people that are waiting to pour into the young people. So, yeah, the future is looking great for Atlanta.
Abia Dunn Henderson, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
She's founder of Gangsters to Growers, and also Dariante Trent, Raven Cantrell, trainees in the program. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you for having us.
Okay, the indulgences of the holidays are behind us, and dry January is trending. Maybe you've seen posters at your doctor's office or social media posts from people giving up drinking alcohol for a month. But it is more than a fad for those who struggle with alcohol abuse or other substance abuse addictions. While the opioid crisis rightfully gets a lot of attention, far more people die each year from alcohol. Researchers from the University of Washington found that the number of deaths attributable to alcohol rose from 35% from 2007 to 2017, and that Georgia is the state with the second highest rates of deaths, followed by Alabama at number three. Neil Campbell is executive director of the Georgia Council on Substance Abuse and is joining me now in the studio. Neil, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And Amanda Abraham, she's joining us from WUGA in Athens. She's assistant professor of public administration and policy at the University of Georgia and studies treatment options for substance abuse. Hello, Amanda.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much. Neil, going to start with you, an official from the Institute of Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington, which authored the study I quoted, says the real story here is no one has noticed the slow rise in deaths attributed to alcohol. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's because it's socially acceptable in a lot of ways. I think that it's difficult to measure when someone goes from drinking in a normal way to drinking in a problem way, in a risky or health risky way. So I think a lot of those factors just play. It's such a socially acceptable thing in our culture.
It's harder. It's slower moving, I suppose, and harder to criticize. Amanda, what are some alcohol-related diseases or causes of death? Amanda, are you with us?
Yes. So alcohol is associated with a range of health conditions, including several types of cancer. Cirrhosis of the liver, of course, puts people at higher risk for accidents, car accidents, and other types of accidents as well.
Well, we've heard reports in recent years that drinking a glass of red wine may be beneficial to the health. So what is considered alcoholic drinking? Who wants to pick that up, Neil?
Oh, that's a good question. The National Institutes on Health have limits for both males and females, depending on body weight, depending on how much you've used in the past. So you can measure, you know, you can figure that out, what is harmful use and what's not for yourself. I think that it really is dependent on where you're coming from, what your history is, and, you know, all of those factors that play into it. I want to just mention that we have a program up in Northeast Georgia where we have peer recovery coaches in emergency departments who talk to people who have either experienced overdose or any other kind of substance issue. And alcohol by far is the most is the reason that most people are coming into the emergency rooms as well. So it's not only just, you know, health conditions, it's also what's bringing people to the attention of officials, either in an emergency room setting or in police department with DUIs and things like that.
Yeah, it looks like epidemiologists have been really looking at alcohol, have seen a huge rise in ER visits because of alcohol. And we're going to put this conversation on hold for just a minute while we take a break. We're talking about the disease and treatment of alcoholism with Neil Campbell, Executive Director of the Georgia Council on Substance Abuse. And Amanda Abraham is also with us, Assistant Professor of Public Administration and Policy at UGA. Stay with us. We're continuing the conversation right after the break. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. It is dry January in Britain, where the idea originated. More than 3 million are off the sauce for the first month of the year. It's caught on in the U.S. as a public health campaign and social media trend. And while the opioid crisis deserves a lot of attention, there are far more alcohol-attributed deaths in the U.S. each year. We're talking about the disease and treatment of alcoholism with Neil Campbell, Executive Director of the Georgia Council on Substance Abuse, and Amanda Abraham. She's Assistant Professor of Public Administration and Policy at UGA. So is the increase in heavy or binge drinking within any particular populations, Neil, that you've noticed?
I think it's always a concern with young people, especially in colleges. There's a social researcher named Bill White who says that colleges are abstinence-hostile environments where a lot of social activities are around alcohol. And, you know, sometimes young people don't have the best judgment around their use, and it's just used as kind of central to everything that they do. I know in my case, I also wanted to mention I'm a person in recovery from alcoholism. And for me, that means it's been a little over 28 years since I've had my last drink.
Well, congratulations.
Right, thank you. And I speak about it because I want everybody to know that it's possible. And when I was in college, you know, there's parts of my undergrad I don't remember because of alcohol and because it was just so available and just so sort of the expectation as well.
So that is the social, let's say, social atmosphere for alcohol and alcoholism and binge drinking especially to develop. But now we have an idea, or we're characterizing alcoholism as a diagnosis, alcohol substance abuse disorder?
Substance use disorder.
Okay, mm-hmm. So this is in the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistic Manual. But you said you're in long-term recovery. Now, isn't that something where you sort of diagnose yourself? You say, I have a problem?
I got to that point where I could say I had a problem. So I would wake up every day, you know, before I was 30, I got better when I was 30. I got sober when I was 30, but I would wake up every day and say, I am not going to drink today. And every day I drank. It wasn't until I had some social support, I didn't hang around anybody who didn't drink. I didn't trust anybody who didn't drink. So I eventually got to know someone who was in recovery, and he just noticed that I was having some of the symptoms, and some of the things that happened in his life were happening in my life. And he said, it doesn't have to be like this. And that was the first time I heard. I thought, this is just what it's going to happen. I'm going to hit bottom. I'm either going to die or go to jail. And I realized it didn't have to be like that because someone else told me, someone who had been through it.
But now, more and more, we know a lot more about brain science and how drugs and alcohol affect the brain. And this idea of the diagnosis of alcohol substance abuse disorder, it's medicalizing it. It's identifying alcoholism as a disease. How does that change the thinking around alcoholism?
Well, hopefully I think it's a good thing, actually. I think I'd love to hear Amanda's thoughts on this as well. I think we should have a public health approach to addiction and to substance use and people with substance use disorders. I think you're right. Brain science does say that we have this powerfully reinforcing psychoactive substance in our brains that's causing us to think a certain way or act a certain way. So it's got behavioral implications, but it's that substance that's in our brains that's affecting our neurotransmitters, right? So it's not so easy as just to say, you know, this is a moral weakness. It's just a crutch. You need to stop. We know that that's not the case. Again, in my own experience, I know that's not the case. It's not until you have a series of interventions. For some people, like for me, I needed to have a couple of things happen before I actually got better. However, what it's also showing us, if you think of it like diabetes, you don't have to be in a diabetic coma to get better. You don't have to hit bottom to get better. You can pull this back anytime. You can stop. We always say the elevator gets off at every floor. Let's figure out ways that help you, whether it's reducing drinking or drug use or whatever it is that's working in your life.
How about that, Amanda? How does looking at the medical aspect or the brain aspect of alcoholism change the way that we think about treatment?
I think that that really can reduce the stigma associated with addiction. Like Neil just stated, there is a moral aspect and people get stigmatized, and the idea that people could just stop drinking if they wanted to. But the idea, of course, that it is a chronic medical condition that will require a lifetime of care, just like diabetes or hypertension would, is really changing that. And we also have medical treatments available to people with alcohol and opioid use disorder and a range of evidence-based treatment options for people. And again, I think that medicalizing it reduces the stigma associated with it, and hopefully that'll get more people into treatment, because right now, only about 10% of people that need treatment in a given year actually seek treatment. And a lot of that is related to insurance, the barriers related to insurance, and also the stigma associated with seeking treatment.
Well, I want to dig into that a little bit, because it seems that this has become a bit of a rift within the rehabilitation or treatment community, the idea that there is a sort of spiritual problem. That's the 12-step approach, that, you know, there's something that makes you want to drink. And then there is the more medicalized idea that you can get treatments that embrace all of these kind of techniques that block receptors or craving receptors for alcoholism. Amanda, can you help us understand some of the distinctions between those?
Absolutely. So really, there are a lot of evidence-based treatment services available to patients. And so that's really what we want to see people get. And that could be behavioral therapies that are evidence-based, so things like motivational interviewing, cognitive behavioral therapy. And there's also medications that are FDA-approved to treat both alcohol and opioid use disorder. And so I really don't view it as one or the other. It's really up to the individual patient and their provider to decide what is the best treatment course for them. And that might include medications and behavioral therapy or behavioral therapy alone. It's really not a one-size-fits-all treatment that is appropriate for all patients.
Well, it seems like every couple of years we see articles or disputes over whether AA or 12-step programs are evidence-based, though they're relied on by some calculations about 85% of rehabs across the country. So Amanda doesn't see it as a rift. How about you, Neil?
It's a rift within the recovery communities, for sure. Mm-hmm. I know in a lot of 12-step, I'll just go back old school. Mm-hmm. I was told when I walked into the rooms, you are not to be on any medication. Whether it was an SSRI, an antidepressant type, or whether it was something that was helping with the cravings, you were told that's not real recovery. That's starting to change, and we think that's a good thing. You would never tell someone who suffers from diabetes that this medication is not for you if it worked. I mean, there are certain medications and certain things that work for certain people at certain times. And I also want to mention that there's a cultural component to all of this. You can't, if you go to a substance abuse rehab and you don't complete that rehab, so many times we're told that's your fault. It's not the fault. You're to blame. You're not mm-hmm. ready for this. Mm-hmm. Go out and do more research. Well, that kills people in many times, right? You have to, it's not just that, because if you go to a doctor for diabetes and he tells you, hey, this drug isn't working, we'll try something else. Why don't we do that in substance use as well? We should be trying other things that work for other people, because like Amanda said, with the stigma, that keeps many people from getting help. There's in certain neighborhoods, in certain cultures, you're not going to go and look for help and go to those where those people go, right? So I think we have to look at the whole, in a holistic way, we got to look at communities. And if only 10% of the folks who need treatment are getting it, how are people staying well? Because people are staying well. We see it all the time. There's communities that are standing up and saying, hey, we want to take care of people. We want to make some recovery-friendly spaces. We want to make sure everybody can get the help that they need.
Well, we've heard over and over again during the opioid crisis that the opposite of addiction is community, that right. there needs to be not just one person involved, but they have to feel a sense of belonging. Is that the value of being a part of like the AA groups or fellowships?
Yeah, absolute. Connection is everything. And addiction can be very isolating. It can be very scary. We always say the opposite of addiction is connection. It's human connection. We operate a peer support warm line where you can call 365 days out of the year between 8:30 and 11 at night just to get a peer recovery coach on the other end of the phone to listen. We call it radical listening. We're not trying to push anybody a certain way or pull them a certain way. We're just there to say, hey, we've been there and we can help. And because we believe people know what's best for them.
We're talking about alcoholism today and treatment and various different kinds of treatments. It's something that has changed a lot, especially during the huge opioid crisis that has overtaken the United States. Do you think, Amanda, that that has changed the landscape of opioid treatment over the past few years? Do you think people are aware of addiction differently? And do you think that opioids and alcoholism need to be treated differently?
I think that the opioid crisis has brought a lot of attention and a lot of funding and a lot of opportunities to the addiction treatment system. And I think that's positive. As we stated before, alcohol does affect more people than opioids, but the crisis itself has brought a lot of much needed attention to the issue generally. And I think that could be leveraged in a very positive way to increase access and quality of both treatment for alcohol and opioid use disorder. And so I do think it is bringing attention to it and changing the way that people think about it and really, again, promoting a more medical view of this, not as a moral issue, but as a chronic brain disease.
Well, your research focuses on addiction health services. What kind of services exist here in Georgia for people suffering from addiction?
There's a range of services available for people in Georgia with substance use disorder across the continuum of care. That includes outpatient services, inpatient and residential, and recovery support services. We also have over 50 opioid treatment programs in the state, which are licensed to dispense methadone. And then outside the specialty treatment system, we have office-based providers that are waivered to prescribe buprenorphine for opioid use disorder treatment. And I would say really the services available to Georgians depend on where they live, because that can affect your access to treatment and what type of insurance people have.
Yeah,
so there are some. Go ahead.
Well, what kind of barriers do insurance create for people who want to or need treatment?
Well, a lot of people with substance use disorder simply don't have health insurance. And so about 50% of people seeking treatment prior to Medicaid expansion actually lacked insurance at all. And then there are barriers if you do have insurance. Does your insurance cover the type of treatment that you need? And then are there utilization controls or limits put on those services? So, for example, a lot of health insurers require prior authorization for buprenorphine, which is a medication used to treat opioid use disorder. So that creates additional paperwork, essentially, for the provider. So it's an administrative burden. And it also may cause patients to have to wait up to 3 days to receive treatment. And that's not what we really want to do. If someone's finally ready to seek treatment, we don't want to try and make them wait, for them to have to wait for several days to actually access that treatment.
Right. So what? I'm sorry, Amanda.
Yeah, go ahead.
What other preventable, treatable chronic health condition do you know where you have to actually have that kind of authorization? You don't.
That's a great point. Exactly.
So people are kept from treatment. And the insurance company, the insurance world has not caught up with what really helps with substance use disorders. It's not something that you can treat in an acute care setting. Right? Because treatment for many people is just the beginning of recovery. So recovery supports have to be in place. And
absolutely,
the insurance companies don't pay for that typically.
Well, it's interesting because the Trump administration was initially critical of medication-assisted treatment, from my understanding that, you know, the idea was we're just substituting one opioid for another. But now, after the announcement of $1 billion in grants to expand access, it emphasized that only programs that made these medicines available would be eligible. So what does that mean for, you know, traditional recovery centers for, as you mentioned, cognitive behavioral therapy, recovery in 12-step groups?
They're catching up, too. I mean, I think it's causing us to sort of expand our view of what this is. And I agree with Amanda, that's a good thing. It's having us look at this as a chronic health condition as opposed to just something that can be treated one way. So I think you have to have a lot of options for folks, especially, you know, a lot of the young people who are coming into services. It's going to look a lot different for someone who is recovering from opiate use disorder in the long term than it is maybe for someone who's coming in for a cocaine use disorder. So it's just, it's different. It's having us realize that recovery is, first of all, it's deeply personal and that it comes in a lot of different ways to people.
Why is it so much worse? Deaths from alcoholism, can both of you looking at this system in states like Georgia, in states like Alabama, what can states be doing to change the outcomes?
Well, every state has an official that's in charge of all of the federal money and the state money that comes through their offices. And so they're starting to recognize that recovery supports are very important. Things like recovery, peer recovery coaching, things like having, having this screening in schools where young people are getting a message that it's, you know, of health and of actual good education around what this does to your brain. Because if you tell kids, what we have do some work at Decatur High School, and if you let them know what's really going on and give them good, honest information, kids will back off of their harmful use. They can do that. So I think states are responding in a lot of creative ways, and I think it's actually really good.
How about the traditional, you know, putting a higher tax on alcohol, restricting hours, that kind of thing? Are those effective?
I think putting, you know, these sin taxes, I think, can work. I think as long as they're going to fund real grassroots or real treatment and getting to the people. Sometimes that doesn't happen. It's just used to buy equipment or whatever. But so I think some of those taxes can be a good thing. I don't have the evidence in front of me of whether they work or not. But I think that's an example of a creative way to think about some solutions.
Amanda, what have you seen?
In terms of?
What is effective for states helping to actually curb alcoholism or alcohol abuse disorder?
I think that one thing that states that haven't done this could do would be expand Medicaid, because what we've really seen in states that have done this is that they've decreased the number of uninsured people with a substance use disorder, alcohol or opioid use disorder that then have access to treatment through Medicaid. And that's really, you know, very important step that the state could take. And that also allows the state, because a lot of people who are uninsured are going to be funded through a federal block grant or other local funds. So the state would be able to recapture those funds and use them in ways that best serve the needs of the state.
Yeah, we have to wrap, but what should somebody, given the variety of treatments and options, who feels like they're really out of control, their drinking has gotten to them, where should they go?
Well, I would encourage people to call 844-326-5400 is a recovery support warm line where they can talk to a peer recovery coach to see what their next step is. There isn't one right answer for anyone, but I would say talk about it, reach out for help. We have at the Georgia Council, there's 35 people that work for us. All of us are in long-term recovery. So I just want to give that message of hope that someone, that you're not alone, that it's nothing to be ashamed about. There's hope, and there are people out there who really want to help.
Neil Campbell, Executive Director of the Georgia Council on Substance Abuse, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
And Amanda Abraham, Assistant Professor of Public Administration and Policy. She's at UGA. Amanda, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, that's all the time that we have for today. I'm Virginia Prescott. We thank you so much for spending some time with us. This is On Second Thought.